All right, we are ready for the afternoon. Any comments or questions before we go on? Anybody? Any comments or questions? All right, then. Let me go ahead. The first session after lunch, we have been talking about the arts and the impact of inspiration. Today we're going to talk about tapping the power of inspiration through oratory. Hence the guy with the
top hat.
It is said, not by me, but it is said that President Obama is a golden-tongued orator, the most gifted communicator we have witnessed since President Reagan. Yet I have watched him speak, both in formal settings with a teleprompter and off the cuff without one, and I have never once observed clairvoyantly the inflow of inspiration from above the mean overshadowing. I have indeed observed this overshadowing during debates and speeches in George W. Bush, in Dick Cheney, in Liz Cheney, and of course, in President Reagan. Always the inflow of inspiration was followed by an unscripted comment or remark that cut to the heart of the issue and scored points. We need to create a new ideal for a speech, one that captures the essence of an idea and conveys it powerfully and brilliantly to the audience. Churchill did this magnificently in any number of his speeches. Here is an excerpt from his first speech after becoming prime minister, sometimes known as the blood, sweat, tears, and toil speech, although that's the wrong order. Let me try to get this running. And
demonstration of this scale and complexity is a serious undertaking in itself. But it must be remembered that we are in the preliminary stage of one of the greatest battles in history, that we are in action at many points in Norway and in Holland, that we have to be prepared in the Mediterranean, that the air battle is continuous, and that many preparations have to be made here at home. In this crisis, I hope I may be pardoned if I do not address the House at any length today. I hope that any of my friends and colleagues or former colleagues who are affected by the political reconstruction will make all allowances for any lack of ceremony with which it has been necessary to act. I would say to the House, as I said to those who have joined the government, I have nothing to offer but blood, toil, tears, and sweat. We have before us an ordeal of the most grievous kind. We have before us many, many long months of struggle and of suffering. You ask, what is our policy? I will say, it is to wage war by sea, land, and air, with all our might, with all the strength that God can give us, to wage war against a monstrous tyranny never surpassed in the dark and lamentable catalogue of human crime. That is our policy. You ask, what is our aim? I can answer in one word, victory. Victory at all costs. Victory in spite of all terror. Victory, however however long and hard the road may be, but without victory there is no survival. Let that be realized. No survival for the British Empire. No survival for all that the British Empire stood for. No survival for the urge and impulse of the ages that mankind will move forward towards its goal. But I take up my task with buoyancy and hope. I feel sure that our cause will not be suffered to fail among men. At this time I feel entitled to claim the aid of all. And I say, come then, let us go forward together with our united strength.
Okay.
The great air battle, which had been in progress over
the last few weeks,
has recently attained.
I'm not going to make you sit through it. I'm not going to make. What?
We couldn't hear much of it anyway. No.
Well, I had the volume up.
I know.
As high as possible.
I know.
For those of you who did hear it, what do you make of it?
He was one with his words. His soul was on the line there. It was, I just couldn't picture anybody not wanting to end up being captive.
Right. Anything else?
Well, he actually used the V word.
Victory.
Yes, he did. He used the V word.
He
victory.
Used the V word, which Obama seems to be afraid of.
He made it very clear that his policy was to fight war, and his goal was
victory,
complete victory. And he
also used.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry. He also used the G word, which most of the country is terrified to use as well, about working with all of our might, with all of the strength that God can give us. So I thought that was a significant line there.
Yeah.
Not only the future of the British, but of humanity. It's like, this is, our future is contingent on this.
Right. And he was absolutely right. So he clearly laid out the goals and objects and the idea, and he embodied that. I condensed this down. The entire speech is about twice as long, about 5 minutes and 15 seconds. The first half that I left off was where he said, I was asked last Friday to form a government. I've done this, I've done that. He recited what he had done and what would be done in the days to come. But one of the key elements that was left out then was he made it clear that he had deliberately created a government as broad-based as possible, that he included the leaders of all parties in his government. And that was the basis for his statement, I call on the aid of all. This is a unity government representing all parties, all political persuasions, were all united in the common cause of victory. So it really was a tremendously unifying speech. I think there's a few other speeches that have come close to that. We'll talk about some of them in a little bit. I think Lincoln achieved the same effect in the Gettysburg Address. And even more powerfully in the second inaugural address, when he talked about with malice toward none and charity toward all, this is the capacity of a great orator to capture the essence of the idea he wants to convey and to be an agent of divine inspiration through the words that are spoken. This is not done just by having skills in rhetoric. There has to be a connection. There has to be an outpouring from this leader out to all the listeners. And this is something that can be anticipated, it can be understood. I first recognized this quality in a very unusual setting. When I was at Dartmouth, most of you don't know this, but when I was at Dartmouth, I belonged to a fraternity, and our fraternity made it a point to use the fraternity system to provide stimulating programs. We would have a forum where we would talk about world issues, Vietnam, and political issues, and so on and so on and so on. We staged an art show or two and things like that. Things that you don't normally associate with fraternities. We were trying to redefine the fraternity system of Dartmouth. And it got into my head that we should, of course, I never take these things too seriously, so I sponsored a poetry reading at the fraternity. It was a poetry reading of obscene and scatological poetry. I invited any number of my professors, most of whom turned out for it from the English department, and had a surprising collection of obscene and scatological poetry. And we packed the hall where we were having this. This was at the fraternity. It was the party room. It was a large room, very large. We packed it. People were in there. There were Vietnam veterans that had their own scatological, especially limericks. And as I was leading this, I was aware that I was being overshadowed by some spooks who very much enjoyed the humor. And it was really my first contact with unbridled joy from the higher levels. One might, a prude might be shocked to hear that I would have support from upstairs for a bawdy poetry reading. But some of them had been waiting hundreds of years for this opportunity. And we had an enormously good time. And everybody thoroughly enjoyed themselves. Most everybody got half drunk, of course. But I noticed that I was the MC, and as I was doing this, I had no particular script. I had an order or a sequence to read stuff in. But the input that overshadowed me while I was doing my MC work, I was cracking jokes and making double entendres that I never anticipated. I certainly had not rehearsed or prepared. It was a inflow of great joy and celebration, as, of course, human sexuality always should be. And, of course, while there was some scatological stuff, most of it was of a sexual nature, as one might presume with a college audience. Anyway, it was a great success, but the point here is that the opportunity of oratory in front of an audience is that you can be overshadowed and inspired on the fly, so to speak. I am aware of this same presence and overshadowing with every poetry performance that we present here in Marble Hill, which is, we've now done a dozen or so of them, maybe more. And every time there is a palpable presence that sinks in, and even though I do have a script, there is a level of joy and inspiration that inspires every one of the readers. And this kind of psychic connection creates a triangle with the speaker and the audience at the two ends of the baseline, and higher intelligence, whether it's spooks or the soul or the divine, at the apex. So can you... Yes?
Maybe everybody else knows the definition of scatological, but I don't.
Dirty. I can't move one. It's a polite way of saying dirty. Scatological is a reference to what might be euphemistically referred to as bathroom humor.
Okay.
Yes.
An animal's droppings are called scat.
Okay. Is that why we say scat cat? Anyway, scatological it has to do with, as that indicates, bathroom humor. There's some really wonderful, talented poets that have contributed to that. You'd be surprised. Again, one of my contentions is if we let high school students read the real poems written by Jonathan Swift and Alexander Pope and Eugene Field of Little Boy Blue, you'd be surprised what he meant by come blow your horn. Boys especially would be much more interested in English literature if we threw them a little bit of, what Nancy referred to as droppings. I want to ask you, can you give me examples of great oratory that you've witnessed yourself or read about or seen in movies or TV, remembering that my definition here is that it's as though the performer was overshadowed by something greater than himself.
Carl?
Yes.
I just got the DVD playing Shakespeare.
Oh, yeah.
There's a lot of features in Shakespeare. These actors are talking about how they perform it and they do it, and it's just incredible.
Yes, a lot of that is their talent and their rehearsal that prepares them, but I think any artist will tell you that there are times when they have a transcendent moment on stage and they end up performing at a level they never expected. This is especially true with musicians professional musicians who, whether they play an instrument or sing or whatever they do, they're always giving a professional performance at the utmost of their skill, but there are times when they are overshadowed and they transfix the audience with the power of their performance. That is the overshadowing. It may be in the case of music, it may be angels of music coming in and enriching the quality of their already professional performance. It usually only happens a few times in the career of a concert pianist or musician. But of course, the more the connection develops, and the stronger it develops, the more it becomes regular. And in fact, this is the goal of the technique from the basic course of Pattern of Genius, where you train yourself to be inspired by genius as you're doing a speech or as you're doing playing the piano or whatever. Other examples? Yes, Rose.
Well, this isn't really a speech, but this is certainly seared in my memory.
Seared?
When President Bush was down at Ground Zero and he got the bullhorn and put his arm around the fireman and, said, "Yes, we hear you, the whole world hears you," or something to that effect. And I mean, I think he was definitely overshadowed by the spirit of America, and that one moment just united the whole country.
Well, this is one of the things about leaders. I agree with you entirely with that example, but in addition, there were other times when I could clairvoyantly see the ideas flowing into his mind as he answered a question or commented on some point. And he is a person that had that connection. Like I said, I've never seen that with President Obama except in one instance. And this is my example of one of the greatest speeches ever given. Two words. Joe Wilson standing up and saying, "You lie." Now, he was overshadowed by the spirit of America. There's no question about that. And, of course, It was an historical moment. It was unscripted. He said he didn't know what came over him. I know what came over
him. It just came out.
It was the spirit of America. Other example of oratorical inspiration.
Give me liberty or give me death.
That probably was one. I wasn't there that I remember.
Did somebody mention the Gettysburg Address?
I did, yes. That's another good example. There are plenty of examples from TV, from, of course, radio. All of Churchill's speeches were delivered over the radio. It's part of our treasures of civilization that we have Churchill delivering his speeches. He wasn't a great rhetorician. He didn't. He kind of swallowed some of his words. He was a great writer, but he had to overcome a stutter in order to speak. And he was not the most confident speaker, but he was a great wit and knew how to deliver, knew how to make contact.
Oh, when you brought up the stuttering, what was it?
The King's Speech.
The King's Speech.
Yeah, that's a great movie demonstrating a lot
of
those.
Yeah.
What about Ronald Reagan when he addressed the Challenger disaster?
Okay, I thought both. Right, that speech, and also when W talked about the disintegration on reentry of what was that, Columbia? Back about 8 or 9 years ago. Tremendously moving speeches. I'm not sure that they were overshadowed as much as simply their speechwriters and themselves put together really wonderful speeches at that time, but they were inspired.
Sure. Well, you mentioned one of the days about Reagan and the tear down that wall.
Yeah.
That certainly
tear down that wall speech was certainly of that type. Certainly in campaigning, he had any number of great moments where he ad-libbed a brilliant line.
Mm-hmm.
Was there somebody else contributing here? Okay, those are excellent moments in the Harry Potter. I think the Harry Potter, especially the last one, the great speech of that was the speech Neville Longfellow gave.
Longbottom
gave when everybody thought Harry was dead.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And of course, that's a fictitious speech, but it was extremely well crafted and well delivered by the character, by the actor. Anything else? Who else?
Carl?
Yes. Right, that was the speech of Reagan gave in nominating Goldwater was basically his entree into the national political scene. It made him a player on the national scene, and it was after that that he ran for governor of California and won and served 2 terms and then ran for president. Absolutely. Who else? Dorothy, did you have something to say?
Yeah, I was going to say Benjamin Netanyahu's address to the Congress.
Yes.
Months ago, perhaps?
Yes.
Okay.
I think so. Rose, did you have something else to say?
Well, this is from the book, Divine Healing of Mind and Body.
Right.
But the overshadowing of Myrtle McDonald Bain.
Right. I don't think you can get a better example than that. If you all didn't hear that, Rose was referring to the book Divine Healing of Mind and Body by Myrtle McDonald Bain. Basically, Myrtle gave about 12, 14 weekly addresses back in 1948. And in each one, he, in essence, left his body while he was standing there, and he was taken over by the Christ, and who then spoke through him for an hour or so, or 40 minutes or whatever. And it was faithfully recorded. I don't think they had taping devices back then, but it was recorded stenographically. And just reading those sermons or lectures or whatever, you can sense the palpable presence of the Christ. But they also include in that various testimonies from people who participated, such as I. Bagot Smith, our favorite, and saying how the whole room was transfigured when the presence of the Christ took over and spoke through Myrtle McDonald Bain. So that's probably the epitome of this. The thing we have to go back and understand as an origin here is that there are many mythical traditions of oracles. The priestesses at Delphi were oracles. And every culture on the face of the earth has had in distant times oracles where people would go and listen to the voice of God. The oracle was considered the voice of God. And that's what we're trying to create here, is an understanding that at its highest level, great oratory is connected with the divine and serves as an agent for the divine. And it's that which distinguishes these speeches, comments, whatever, from mere charisma or brainwashing. Clever speakers are able to hypnotize their audience into believing nonsense. Charismatic people are able to stir a response in their listeners at the emotional level. But these are things that we are prone to encounter in a demagogue rather than in an inspired speaker. An inspired speaker will never demagogue. They will speak from inspiration. Now, it's not easy to teach this in a traditional sense. It must be presented as a possibility and hope that with practice, each student develops some capacity. Still, there's one suggestion that can be made, which is relevant to teaching students in Walden Grove and also in Walden Ultra, and that is before speaking, any time before you give a presentation, flood yourself with truth and lucidity. Or if you're performing in a play, flood yourself with the essence of your character. Think of the light of higher intelligence flooding your being. You can go so far as to invoke the inspiration of the muse persona. And will we teach the muses and the graces in Walden Grove? You bet your sweet bippy.
Okay.
That is why we reinvented or restored or revived the muses and the graces, so that this is something that intelligent people can talk about without having to pretend that they're doing something occult. And it just makes great good sense to invoke the muse persona anytime you're going to give a speech, anytime you're going to give an oral presentation, anytime you're going to speak ad lib or perform on the theater stage, that's something that can be practiced, and you'll have a chance to practice later on. Oratory differs from the other arts by dint of establishing a direct, real-time connection between higher intelligence and an audience. Literature establishes that if the audience is capable of reading above the line, but it's not in a real-time, everybody sharing it at the same time kind of thing. The performer or speaker becomes the conduit or the paraclete between heaven and earth. This is the ideal. We must keep in mind that it seldom happens, but we must cherish it when it does. Okay, any final comments or questions about this? Anybody? No? All right. All right, that's time to move on to our second session here. And this session, each afternoon, is devoted to the history of peace. And today I want to talk about it in terms of oneness. Nations traditionally have formed for protection against foreign invasion and to establish internal concord among groups. Hence, the story of history has been grafted onto a scaffolding of wars. But the history of peace, which is largely unwritten, is in truth a far more fascinating story. To a degree, the emergence of anthropology, sociology, and all those other ologies, some people call them soft social sciences, has been an attempt to study the achievements of peace rather than wars. But these attempts have largely failed as academics have gotten wrought up in studying things like territorial imperatives and other nonsense, which takes them right back to war. To me, the great story of America as a nation is summed up in its motto, E Pluribus Unum. Of course, since none of you took Latin, you probably don't know what that means. Out of the many, one. Okay, I stand corrected.
I took Latin.
Good. I stand corrected. 3 out of 12 of you took Latin.
I took Latin, that's right.
Okay. Then you know what E Pluribus Unum means. Out of the many, one. I would offer the theory that it is the desire for unity, for oneness, that brings people together into a nation, not the need for defense against foreign aggression. They may be connected, but it's that drive for unity that is unconscious and unspoken that really brings people together. Keep in mind that every nation is an outpicturing of a group on an inner plane, on the inner plane. A racial group that goes back thousands of centuries. And they've been doing their thing together. It's a mixture of all different kinds of people and all different races and all different backgrounds. And some people have lived in one country one time, but we tend to respond to the call of the spirit of the nation that we've been connected to. And it's not the physical territory that calls us together and draws us together. It's the spirit of that nation. So pressures to divide any nation should therefore be sternly resisted, because the dynamic is unity, not divisiveness. Our study of esoteric psychology confirms this. I couldn't talk about this except that all of you know what I'm talking about. The best leader of a nation is strong with is one with a strong Ray 1 influence blended with other rays, of course. If we elected a leader that could not respond strongly to Ray 1, they would dither and dawdle and not be very effective. Ray 1 seeks to synthesize, to unite the many and the diverse into a common experience. How does this transformation occur? How do we confront the selfish interest groups in our country and help them respond to the greater good of all the people concerned? I'm soliciting your opinion, your insights, your ideas.
Is confrontation really what we want, or is it better to maybe to the, you know, as long as they, you know, to maybe just stand back and let them learn from? Because I sense that America is learning, that people are learning from the election results, from Obama's election, and from the election of having all the Democrats controlling Congress.
Well, I don't think that it's a question of learning from the election. The election sums up what has been learned, which may or may not be a good thing. But there, I think you're right that the public is learning, sometimes to its chagrin, from the actions of the current government. It's not the election that is the learning process, it's the evaluation of the actions. And so I think that's what causes learning. What you raised the question, what would be your answer? Is confrontation the way that this is learned?
Well, I think if you confront people, I guess it depends upon your definition of confrontation. If you, you know, we talked yesterday about, you know, questioning, you know, and questioning with boldness, as Welbeck would say, with caring and kindness and goodwill, but questioning people and trying to encourage people to trace back their ideas or their you know, to the origins.
Okay. What say the rest of you? Is confrontation a natural part of the human condition, or is it unnatural? Does it promote growth, or is it a retardant to growth?
Well, I believe Ray Forrest is described as harmony through conflict, and humanity is Ray Forrest.
Okay. Rose just said that humanity is Ray Forrest, and the definition of Ray Forrest is harmony through conflict. Yes.
If the leader sounds the principles that the country was founded on, he could unite, even though doing that would cause the people taking sides and arguing. But it would, I mean, a strong leader would be clear about the purpose and like say the Constitution and sounding the importance of living up to our ideals.
Okay. What is the single greatest example of harmony in our country's history?
Civil War.
Exactly. The Civil War. The Civil War was the most bitter confrontation we've had, and since then, the North and the South get along with hardly anything more than a nervous laughter or two. There are, you know, I have friends down here that continue to insist on calling it the War of Northern Aggression, but that particular friend served in Congress, so I don't think he too serious. The point is that when you have serious differences, you have to air them honestly and learn that there's something stronger than those differences that unite you. So confrontation for the sake of confrontation, no. Confrontation for the sake of creating harmony, yes. What are some of the forces of divisiveness in our country today?
The rules for radicals.
Unions?
Well, explain why. He being reminded that some of the people attending this class are union members. Maybe not willingly, but they are. Yes?
Because the concepts that they're living by are outdated, and they have not updated themselves. And they want to be combative, and rather than finding creative ways to make themselves viable.
And what was the great example of leadership in the face of that?
Say yes.
What was the great example of leadership in the face of that union sabotage?
That was Reagan.
Absolutely. There was Reagan firing the air traffic controllers and basically ending the union that way. What happened on Tuesday? The union spent $12 million.
$25
million. No.
Oh, okay.
Go ahead. Who was going to say something?
Would Walker and Kasich be examples of true leadership in the midst of the current union thuggery?
Well, I think there's a lot of examples of good leadership. Those both would be examples. But on Tuesday, the unions, offended by Walker's victory over them earlier, tried to recall enough Republicans to seize control of the Senate in Wisconsin, and the unions poured $12 million from out-of-state money into that effort, and they came up short. And in fact, since there's two Democrats yet to be voted on for recall, they may not gain anything.
So that was just a case again of, like with health care, we the people said we didn't want it and got it shoved down our throats anyhow, so the unions in Wisconsin were not willing to accept that. They thought maybe the people didn't really mean it or what? So they spent all that money to discover that, guess what? That is what the people meant.
Right. And I want to point out that Wisconsin is one of the most liberal states in the nation. The unions had counted on that being a done deal for a long time. Well, their time has now ended in Wisconsin. And that's an example of a confrontation whereby sticking to one's guns, it turns out that the manipulator, the thugs or whatever, came out on the short end of the stick. Yes, buddy?
Ohio has a similar confrontation, if you will, coming up in our November election, as there's this thing on the ballot to repeal SB5, which was what the Ohio legislature passed to limit the collective bargaining of unions. They have an issue on the ballot to get rid of that. So that will also be a test.
Yeah. Well, tests are good. We should... Yes?
Speaking of the union, one of the things to recall is that all in our entertainment unions are affiliated with the International Labor Movement, which is certainly an unconsistent.
Sure.
It's hard to track it for being down like that. You know, they don't put it under the teachers' union threw up a coalition for the government.
Sure. Now, what that is that's an example of foreign forces of divisiveness in our country. There are many, many we can point to. The very fact that we are the new world as opposed to the old world, every time somebody says, well, look at Sweden, they've got this or that or the other, or look at Cuba, they've got health care, national health care. This attempt to compare us to other nations, especially to the old world, we need to build up, through education, an awareness that we're doing it our way, Their way is fine. We should let them alone to do it their way. On the other hand, right now, their way is leading to bankruptcy in Greece, Ireland, Spain and Portugal, and maybe France. So
Italy's in there too.
Yeah, Italy's in there too. So there's nothing much to emulate. We have to be careful to define our own native grown ideas. In this context, ideally the United Nations should draw the nations of the world together. Does it? Or has it tried to lead by imposition rather than by synthesis?
Some of the things that China mentioned encourage divisiveness, like allowing Gaddafi a year or so ago to go on and on and on in his craziness.
Lots of things the United Nations does encourages divisiveness. Can you name something from the United Nations that doesn't encourage divisiveness? I can't think of any example since 1950 where the United Nations has stood for synthesis as opposed to divisiveness.
That may be another one of those organizations that's outlived its usefulness due to the fact that it refuses to update itself into current...
Well, it's not a question of refusing to update itself. It's a question of it outlived its usefulness in about the first 10 years because it was gamed by people who wanted to take over the system, especially the Soviet Union. Even though it monolithically controlled Eastern Europe and other countries, they demanded individual representation in the UN for each one of them. That threw the balance of power out of kilter. And it hasn't recovered since. And so the effectiveness of the United Nations was pretty much run out by 1955, 10 years after it was founded.
So was that the original self-interest group then?
Well, it highlights self-interest groups for sure. Can you cite examples of nations that have collapsed under the threat of division? Collapsed under the force of divisiveness. Korea? All right. Well, just about any bifurcated nation, North and South Korea, North and South Vietnam, the two Irelands, these are all nations that finally decided to simply split rather than reconcile their differences. I think the type of example I'm thinking of is, for example, in the Slavic nations where Yugoslavia was held together artificially by Tito, who had a strong Ray One, albeit destructive, capacity. And once he died, it fell apart. This was the threat in Iraq after Saddam departed. Literally. Here's an interesting question to consider. There's no right or wrong answer here. I just bring it up for your consideration. Is Cuba naturally a part of the United States, or is it a separate entity? If you want to know the reason for bringing this up, it seems to me that most of the leadership vitality of the nation of Cuba resides in Florida. Most of the productive members of Cuba reside in Florida. Cuba is closer to the United States than Puerto Rico. And Puerto Rico is sometimes even talked about as the 51st state. Not that it's reached that point yet, but how does Cuba differ from Hawaii? What about the Philippines? Are the Philippines a natural part of the United States? I'd like to hear your opinions on this, your insights.
Carl, okay. I think it is on the spiritual level.
who are you talking about now? Well, I don't know. One could argue that the only reason Hawaii became a state was because of the military presence there during the Second World War. It was a territory. The Philippines were was a territory, no longer. Cuba is, I think, racially and in many other ways, part of the United States. I think once Castro falls, since there's such a strong presence of Cubans in this country, there may very well be agitation to, first of all, help Cuba rebuild after Castro falls or dies, both of them, and eventually statehood. It'd probably be 25, 50 years before that, but it seems entirely plausible to me. It's not just the proximity of the island, but the interaction of people. And the issue is to look at this from the point of view of the spirit of America. Are the Cubans more responsive to the spirit of America or to communism, which is what Castro represents? I don't know the answer. Like I said, there's no right or wrong. I think Cuba is would be ready for statehood before Puerto Rico if it can shed the communist apparatus. I added the Philippines because the Philippines were made a territory of the United States at the same time as Cuba as a result of the end of the Spanish-American War. But we then turned around and gave Cuba its freedom as well as the Philippines. And so I don't think the Philippines ever would be part, but they have as much claim as a territory to status in the United States as Cuba does. That's why I included it. Well, there.
Like Russia, when, you know, it was communistic, but all these churches, everybody was still carrying on.
Right. Less so in Russia than in Poland. Poland maintained its religious fervor, even though it was repressed. Cuba, having been colonized by the Spanish, has a very, very strong Roman Catholic tradition. And I don't know how much that's been effectively squelched by Castro, but I rather imagine it's still fairly alive and well off. Let's go to a different one. Was the British Empire constructed out of war or out of peace? Indeed, was the Roman Empire constructed out of war or out of peace?
I think out of peace because of trading and commerce.
Well, but then there was Julius...
And discovery.
Yeah.
And discovery.
There's a great deal of that, but then there was Julius Caesar that went to conquer the whole world through war.
Yeah.
So the Roman Empire was perhaps too warlike and insisted on its relied on its military to maintain the peace and the empire artificially, rather than being such benevolent leaders that no one would ever want to be anything other than part of the Roman Empire. However, in the British Empire, one could make more of a case that it was constructed out of peace for commercial purposes. The South Sea trading and so on, less by war. It lost this country because it tried to enforce control of the country militarily. If it had never done that, we'd probably still be speaking about the Queen.
Carl, you can write books like this for the high school exams.
Well, I don't know whether I'm going to write them, but we're going to try to produce books of this nature and this ilk and study these questions.
Where else would you read that?
Exactly. And I think that's a good idea. Is a democracy or a totalitarian regime more likely to go to war with its neighbors?
Democracy is not likely.
Well, in fact, in the last 100 years...
Unless it's provoked.
Well, we're talking about going to war, meaning making war. Defending yourself is not the same as making war. So we exclude defensive activities entirely from this. But in terms of saber rattling and starting a war, in the last 100 years, it's all been totalitarian regimes. Democracies don't do that. Democracies respond, but they don't initiate war. And so that's just a statistical reality. How do we export the ideal of peace? Well, say that with more authority.
Are you speaking to me?
Whoever was talking.
I said through Congress.
Okay, and how has that happened?
Trading and buying and selling.
All right. What other ways can we export the ideal of peace?
Is technology considered part of arms?
Well, you tell me. No, I think that's a separate thing. So we have the arts and we have technology.
That's just inventions.
Inventions, sure.
I'd say peacefulness.
All right, I don't think it's peacefulness as much as it's peacemaking. The line is, if you want peace, you got to become a peacemaker. And as our attitudes in the country shift and change in favor of peacemaking, I mean, driving around with a bumper sticker, envision world peace, does zero, except infuriate other drivers. Saying that you're for peace but doing nothing to promote it in your life is just rank hypocrisy. So we best export the ideal of peace by becoming peacemakers. And of course the League of Nations and the United Nations were both designed to be bodies which would promote peace. I'm not sure that either one of them has done very much toward that. The League of Nations obviously failed. We had the Second World War. The United Nations is directly culpable in promoting the end of the British Empire and the end of the French Empire and the end of the German Empire and all that sort of stuff, and insisting on liberating many, many countries that were not ready to govern themselves. And the result is we have wars all throughout the major area of war in our world today is Africa. And wars of genocide, there are other places as well, largely in the Arab world, where these people and ethnic groups are lagging centuries and centuries behind the development of the rest of the world in terms of peace. You don't see Australia going out and beating up its neighbors. You don't see New Zealand doing that. You don't see the many of the other countries. You still do see it to some degree in areas where there's long-standing animosity, such as between India and Pakistan, although that's been under control somewhat. But that could flare back up. You see it in the Middle East, of course. So, how does one go about being a peacemaker?
Well,
Yes.
As you were talking, I was thinking about some of the individuals from our country who have gone out, say doctors, to different areas and, you know, worked with people just on their dental health, who have given up themselves in that respect. They've just formed their own groups and have gone out to help individuals that may not have been something that was, you know, supported by the country. They just did it as individuals. I think all of those things really, those are peacemakers. And it teaches others about the United States and how we do here.
Well, it's not just the United States, it's lots of countries. I think those things can be done far more effectively by individuals and private groups than by governments. Because when you do it as a government, there's always a political angle to it or an overriding political concern. Whereas Doctors Without Borders and other things can operate very well through private donations and get the work done. Of course, the major force of that historically has been missionaries. Churches having outreach programs in which they interact with other countries. We tried to do some of this with the Peace Corps. I think basically that was a useful project. But it's, of course, been terminated. Going back to this basic question, what promotes peace?
Individuals one-on-one working to be peaceful within their family, neighbors, and so on.
Well, that's the starting point.
Yeah.
But how does that spread out? Anne, did you have an idea?
I have the space program, which of course now has been stopped also.
Well, it hasn't been stopped. The manned space program is in an interlude period, but the space program continues on. How does that promote peace? Especially since it's under the auspices of the Air Force.
Well, there's been some sharing among the nations.
Okay. That's good. Yes, Rose.
With mass consciousness, if you are thoughtful within yourself or at peace within yourself,
well, that's true. However, it's not necessarily going to be a major contributing force unless a lot of people do that. Rose?
Well, this has been mentioned under different titles or whatever, but it would basically be anything that unites
right. The
nations to work together, whatever that might be. If it's the space program, if it's business, commerce, trading, all of those things unite.
Right. Keep in mind that I announced at the beginning of this lecture we were going to talk about the history of peace in terms of oneness. And that's what unites, what synthesizes, what draws us together, two or 300 years ago, all of Europe was a bunch of little city-states, all the individual duchies and kingdoms. Now it's one big umbrella operation which is struggling to exist, but the European community. The tendency towards union promotes peace. The tendency away from union promotes separatism. Yes.
Well, because as companies have... there are a lot of car companies now here, Mazda or Honda. They actually have factories here.
Right.
So, and we have factories and things in other countries. So if you've got those things there, you're not likely to go bomb your own business.
Well, let's put it this way, you're less likely.
You're less likely. Yeah. I don't know if that's skin in the game or whatever, but you've got a reason not to. Because
yes.
You have become a part of that country, a very small part maybe, but you now have a piece of action there, of the action there.
Right. Some other comments.
I have a little list here that might may reveal something. Tourism is one.
Okay.
I was out west in Colorado recently, and half the people at Arches National Park were from other countries.
Okay.
And they were thoroughly enjoying the United States. When there is a disaster somewhere in the world that people respond to globally to help.
Okay.
Sounds
and
like
I was thinking also of the English language as a unifier.
All right.
People are learning English around the world. And I also thought of sort of the positive aspect of immigration in this country and the melting pot.
Sure. Okay. I think those are all good aspects of it. The thing is that as we interact with other people and find that we're the same, with the same kinds of, you know, the people in Arab lands have families and they love their children and they want them to grow up and become decent human beings. There's a few that want them to become walking bombs, but not very many. We gradually break down the distrust of fearing one another. The whole root of terrorism is that these people are afraid of everything around them. They're paranoid about everything. And the only way they know how to try to establish some sense is to go out and wage war against people. We need to cultivate in our entire international community a sense that war should be always the last resort, that we should make sure that we're not in any way motivated by fear of other people, and that if we find out how to interact with people in their native state, we can greatly promote peace and cooperation. So it's a question of sitting down with people, either through an exchange program or living in another country or trading with them or having them attend our universities or we attend their universities or whatever it is, and understanding that these people are human beings that live and breathe and have talents and skills and aspirations, and they're no different than we are. And they get up in the morning, and the sun that shines upon them is the same sun that shines upon us. The moon that shines upon them at night is the same moon that shines upon us. The rains that are generated over Japan come over to our country and rain down nuclear waste. Or volcanic ash or whatever, and we do the same right back at them. We live in a we live on one planet, and we have to figure out a way to share that without constantly beating each other up. And it's in our benefit to work this out. And it's based on what unites us, not what divides us. The great foe of peace is divisiveness, difference, separativeness. The great ally of peace is commonality, shared experience, walking the same path as everybody else.
Carl, we said the arts, but I was specifically thinking of literature.
Uh-huh. Well, it's the same stories.
Same stories.
If you read mythology, you can find the same myth in half a dozen different cultures or similar ones, parallel ones. And if that is taught to elementary students as part of their learning to read, if they understand, for example, that the tree of life, which we are studying in terms of the Kabbalah, the tree of life also appears in North mythology as Yggdrasil. And one of the legends of Yggdrasil, which we just read last, on day three, is that Odin ended up upside down on the tree, and all the letters of the rune, all the runes of the alphabet fell out and cascaded from on high. How is that compared to the Jewish myth of the tree of life, and that all the letters went before God and said, this was before creation, and said, oh, great creator, use me to shape creation. And one by one, God said, well, I will use you in this way, but I'm not going to use you to shape creation because of my special little project for you later on. Until Aleph came forward, and of course, Aleph being the beginning, he said, bingo, I'm using Aleph. Well, that's no different than the myth of Odin in Norse mythology. How is it possible that the Norse mythology, separated by huge distances from Judaism, ends up with the same legend as the Kabbalah? And other nations have similar legends. When we understand that we've all been nurtured in our infancy as a nation on similar ideas and principles, this unites us. The Norse attitude was to extinguish the Jews, the Aryan race. Little did they know that the Aryan race is actually a race originating in India, not in Germany. But that shows how demagogues tend to get it all backwards, and yet societies are the product of a central source, a central creative source, i.e. God. Rose.
I don't know if this is an accurate perception, or the idea that popped into mind was that until humanity actually recognizes itself as one, that we're all humanity, not separate races, that we won't become a sacred planet. That's one of the challenges towards becoming a sacred planet.
Sure.
If we can't see ourselves as one on our own little planet, what would happen when we get out into the universe?
Oh, absolutely.
And come up against people that are really different than us.
Well, I mean, our attitude towards angels is like this. We're at war with the angel kingdom, not literally at war, because they exist in a different dimension, but they can't stand being around humanity that is filling the air with hatred and anger and pollution and rock and roll.
Music.
And God, we can't even live peacefully among ourselves, let alone with other kingdoms. And so the ultimate idea here, and then this will end the session, is that peace is a gift of God. Peace is the divine capacity to find oneness out of diversity, to create wholeness out of the many. And the nations of the earth are, and the groups of the earth are, designed to trace their roots. If you trace your roots back to the beginning, you find that we all came from the same stock. We all came from the same origin. And that that's the true meaning of peace, that we recognize our cultural heritage and learn to get along with one another, cooperate with one another, be proud of what the rest of the world is doing and not try to rule, but rather to cooperate. Okay, any final questions or comments? Input? Yeah. Right.
Okay.
Exactly. That should be a bellwether that we aspire to. All right. It's time for recess. So go recess. And we will be back in about 10 minutes. It's 3:15. Let's start in again at 3:25. And we'll go forward with the afternoon.